I think appraisal, the entire industry can be replaced with AI. And number two, I'm not sure that it shouldn't be. You guys take it from here.
This is Infrastructure Junkies.
Welcome, Infrastructure Junkies, to your show. This is a podcast created by right-of-way professionals for right-of-way professionals. The Infrastructure Junkies podcast is the voice of the right-of-way industry, exploring eminent domain, right-of-way acquisition, and infrastructure development.
Infrastructure Junkies, remember a couple weeks ago? Remember Appraisers Roundtable and we said that was number one? Well, guess what?
What?
This is number two.
Woohoo!
And as it turns out, our guests from number one are still speaking to us barely. We had to call and apologize and make donations to their favorite charities, but they're still
speaking. And buy them dinners.
Buy them McDonald's or something like that. And they decided to come back to continue the discussion, the scintillating discussion about appraisers. I'm Dave Arnold.
I'm Kristen Short.
And today we have Appraisers Roundtable number two. Who do we have?
In case you need a refresher, here's who we've got. We have, once again, the appraiser, the wine connoisseur, the Dave Matthews hippie dancer spinning lady, the hang glider, and the real estate mogul, your friend and mine, Miss Christina Thorson. Hi, Christina.
Hi,
and we also have, joining Miss Christina Thorson, a fellow appraiser extraordinaire who established and manages the Cushman and Wakefield Infrastructure Appraisal Group, hailing from North Carolina, not known for spinning around in a field dancing to Dave Matthews, but he is still a fascinating guy and a fellow infrastructure junkie. Ladies and gentlemen, Anthony Q. Alderman.
Everybody, welcome to be happy to be here.
Is your middle name start with a Q, or was that a lucky guess?
No, sorry, L.
Boring. Okay,
Anthony Loretta Alderman.
Call me Loretta. Let me guess. What's the next line? And for color commentary, Mr. Chicken Sacrifice and Voodoo, the doctor of osteopathy, the DO himself, Mr. Donald Green, also known as Ross.
Just call me Rumpelstiltskin.
Rumpelstiltskin. Today, this is an exciting episode, and I am literally shaking. I can't wait to get down to it. Today's topic with our appraiser friends who are soon to be unemployed is why all appraisers are going to be replaced with AI. Prove me wrong.
Starting off with a bang.
Yeah, we are. I think number one, appraisal, the entire industry can be replaced with AI. And number two, I'm not sure that it shouldn't be. You guys take it from here.
Well, if appraisers, what Christina and I do, can be replaced with AI. I'm sorry, Dave and Ross, but attorneys aren't far behind.
I disagree.
Because we have to, somebody has to testify, man. Somebody's got to get up there and their reputation on the line for that value.
You're going to feed the data into a computer and it's going to give you a value, which you then hold up to the jury.
Yeah, that worked really great with Zillow, didn't it?
Touché.
Well, to be clear, that wasn't AI. That was somebody with some HTML thinking they could do that, that didn't really program a large language model with an appropriate data set. So,
okay, let's get serious. Of course, I don't think appraisers should be replaced with AI, but are we at risk? Are our industries at risk? Are our jobs at risk? Should we just go live in the Matrix somewhere and watch a story?
I think absolutely not. So what I love about the adoption of tech is it allows us as appraisers to do our higher and better use of the analytical skill of parsing the information, of thinking the way a buyer thinks, right? In order to evaluate market activity and market actions to inform and support our opinion of value. And I think AI is going to do the same thing that maybe spreadsheets did. Because people used to calculate discounted cash flow manually, right? Before spreadsheets, before Lotus 1-2-3, right? So I think the evolution of artificial intelligence helping us do a better job is a fabulous thing. And it's going to allow us to get more precise and more analytical and a deeper understanding. We have fact information that can inform our decisions. I'm excited.
That's what the AI wants you to think.
She is an agent of the Chinese government. She's an agent of TikTok.
That's a
TikTok artist right there.
I forgot to mention that in your intro. Yeah.
Huh. Well, let's harken back to part of the discussion in our prior episode with these appraisers where we were talking about the cap rate, and I'm not a fan, but Christina, let me extrapolate what you're saying, and I think I could get on board with this. If you could use AI to calculate a cap rate so that it's less manipulated, so that there's less human manipulation there, and like if you go back to the topics we discussed a couple weeks ago, really my beef with everything is when a human being is manipulating something for an ulterior motive, right? Sure. And you do that with the cap rate. You do it by declaring certain properties as special purpose properties. Ross was talking about depreciation and things like that, or the cost approach. That's my objection is when, gosh, how many appraisers, Ross, have we deposed and they've given an opinion and you're like, well, let's get into the reasons. What are the bases for this opinion? It's like, oh, my experience. And that's it. That's the end of the discussion, seriously. Yeah. So maybe if you could use AI or something that's more objective than subjective or can take multiple sources of information and synthesize it without the manipulation, maybe that would help. Am I off base here?
I think it's some blend of that, Dave, because I think, for example, let's just talk about population forecasts for a minute. Population forecasts inform either growth or decline of how a market could change and how there's going to be demand for more apartments or more office space or whatever that use case is. If you look at forecasts from the Chamber of Commerce versus forecasts from a local university versus forecasts from an independent population demand expert, you might give different weights to those estimates. I'm not sure, and maybe it is, but I'm not sure AI has the ability to do that discernment that we as humans do have the ability to parse out and discern now. And I mean, Anthony can speak to this, but I really think our ability to be unbiased, and there are some bad appraisers, just like there are some bad attorneys.
Darn right there are. No, I admit it. There are.
Yeah. I mean, I think as long as we can act in an unbiased manner and present our information in a way that is credible and not misleading, we still have to discern what information to rely on. Anthony?
Yeah, Dave, to your point, it sounds really nice. I love the idea that there could be this AI black box that I put in an address and it has all the data in it and it just spits out the number. But the problem with any kind of black box is what's inside that box? Where did this data come from? I would imagine there's going to be, if we took this to its nth degree, there'd be the AI that the agency's using to come up with a number. And then it's going to be the AI that the owner's reps are going to be using to come up with their number, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
AI's use, at least in the immediate, and in terms of the appraisal industry and industries at large, we were at that IGC meeting, Dave, when that gentleman about who somehow made bylaws and nonprofit structures interesting.
Yeah.
I forget his name. That was a
fiduciary really, responsibilities when you serve on a board. Right.
He somehow made that engaging and AI came up and I thought he had a good line, which was AI is not going to take your job, but people who know how to use AI will.
That was a great line. I'm glad you remembered that. That's a great line. Well, let's take this. Great points from everybody here, but let's talk about the one approach to value we didn't discuss last time, which is a sales comparison approach. And there's case law that said the courts prefer that. Ross certainly prefers it. I prefer it, to be honest with you. It's something that I can follow a little easier. But there's this little thing called the adjustment grid, where they consider one property superior in this regard and another property is inferior in this regard, and then they assign a correction percentage to that. Man, that's where you really can manipulate the sales comparison approach. And it seems to me, if you could feed into an algorithm the size of the lot, the size of the house, the number of bedrooms, the number of baths, all those things, then those percentages might be a little bit more objective, the adjustment percentages.
Well, and they are. When you're operating in a high sample size environment with ready data, which you are when you're talking about residential sales, then you can sort of see where this is going when you look into mass appraisal or assessment and the technology that goes along with that. Because I got my assessment back for a property. It's a common property type, and it's spot on. For several units, it was just like, nope, this is exactly what it's supposed to be. Like, okay. And you can tell when they're doing it right, when they're in an environment that they have a high sample size and they can collect the data. Because houses, you can do this. Condo units, you can do this. Like, the data is there. It's not hard to figure out in the market, like, how much an extra bedroom does or how much an extra bath does and what's too many and doesn't contribute to value and how does a pool affect it in the sample size. Like, that is all going to be able to be done by a computer with no problem. There's no reason to even need a human in that process. Mm. Like, you can do it just by the math. The presentation of the data, we got to work a little bit further on this uncanny valley, unseemly valley, the thing where if you make a robot that looks too much like a human, everybody wants to murder it. Like,
what?
I'm not familiar.
Look it up. Like, it's a known thing. There's a curve where as things look more human, they become more comfortable to you. So the more something looks like a person, the more you like it. It's why, like, cats aren't, like, people like cats because they have a more human-like face. But then you get too close to looking like people, and the curve drops off into this trough.
Is he making this up as he's going along? Can we talk about the new Billy Squier song?
No.
Wait, I really think y'all need to initiate, I don't know, like a drug test before the podcast.
Wait, hold on. I want to hear the rest of this. So, Ross, like, the more they look like a human, go on.
The more things look like a person up to a certain point, the more humans like it. But when you get too close but not quite there, it drops off dramatically into essentially hostility until you get back to 100% looks like a person. So things that look too much like a person, people find uncomfortable, like dolls, notably.
What about clowns? Clowns.
That makes perfect sense, guys. I'm with you, Ross.
Or those
I'm with
weird
you.
Little monkeys. The little kind
that clang their things together.
Yeah, you're just like, oh, God, man,
what
no.
What is happening
so, Ross, are you saying that an AI created valuation, until it gets to be perfect, it will be at this place where appraisers and lenders want to murder it?
No. Okay. Maybe, but I'm saying that the presentation skills part of the system, the testimony part, you're like, oh, no, that's reserved for us. I'm like, no, it's not. It's just a matter of Boston Dynamics figuring out how to make a robot that looks enough like a person that you're not creeped out by it when it decides to talk in court to give the opinion. So when you get past Mr. Data from Star Trek and you get to, like, a replicant from Blade Runner, like, at that point, the whole AI thing is a distinct problem because this I can put on my testimony. Well, the AI can do that too, son.
So if you walk into court and there is a monkey with a little hat clanging his cymbals together, you have been replaced, appraisers. You have been replaced.
Good to know.
I mean, you could put the AI box in the cymbal clanging monkey, but I don't think people are necessarily going to listen to that. The entire thing has to do with prognostication. Humans love fortune telling. When Christina's talking about forecasting, all you're really talking about is people believing you that you can tell the future. Because until you sell this property, you have no idea what it's actually worth. That's the real worth. This is all just fortune telling. This is, I can tell you the future. I can assure you the value of this asset, even though it hasn't sold, that I can predict what will occur if you were to sell it. So it's all the emperor's new clothes. No. Can you convince people that you know because of appraisal science?
And we're safe, Ross, because we're going to say if you were to sell it as of a certain date, which is past, and you didn't sell it, so if it sells higher or lower, there's some other reason. It wasn't, it has to do with us. The market's changed or whatever, you know, like, so appraisers are in this very strange position of trying to read the tea leaves of the market in the past through market data and participants and all this stuff, but then also make a definitive statement about the market in the present. So it is a strange thing. And hybrid valuations have been approved by Fannie Mae, I believe. So where AI is being used, like Zillow, these, and then they're producing values that then an appraiser does a desktop review on and signs off. So we're well on our way. And most of the appraisal industry does not do what Christina and I do.
True.
And most of them aren't certified general real estate appraisers. Most of this industry are certified residential appraisers who go out and they measure the house and they take pictures of houses in the neighborhood and they provide a value for lending institutions. And we have an issue arising, not necessarily that my job is at stake specifically, but if 80% of my industry is somehow very much lessened and now we only need half of them and we only have to pay them half of what we paid them because they're not doing field inspections anymore because Google cars are now providing the photographs. We're sending Tesla out to take a picture. And so they're just sitting behind a desk kind of checking these boxes. That will impact Christina and I because now how are the appraisal boards funded? So will my fees quadruple? And everybody on my team's fees quadruple. Well, what kind of education providers will there be if we lose a large chunk of the appraisers, even though they're not competitors of mine, they're still make up our sector. So it's concerning.
Well, I don't even know what we're talking about anymore. So here's my question. And I want to play devil's advocate against myself. I don't mind doing that. Highest and best use, and then that's going to back us into the next topic, but highest and best use, can a non-human make that determination? And I think it's much, much less frequent, but sometimes there are manipulations of highest and best use. And I'll give you an example. Some strip takeout in a rural area, the landowner appraiser will say, well, the highest and best use is high traffic convenience store. Walgreens wants this property in a cornfield.
Dollar General out there making this a problem for everybody.
Well, that's a good point. No, that is, I don't know whether, does Dollar General pay a premium like Walgreens does for a per square foot premium for real estate?
Not like Walgreens, but yes.
Really?
Yes.
Well,
they can create problems. It's true.
Spank me and call me Sally. I think that just too many times I've seen this happen where it's very clear that nobody's going to put a Walgreens there. No one's putting a Royal Farms. Nobody's going to put a CVS there. But it's determined that that's the highest and best use.
Then the best use is just dog water.
What's that mean?
Rubbish.
What is dog water?
Go on, Ross.
Hey, so how would you decide what comparable data to consider if you don't first evaluate what the highest and best use of the property is? Or is that an iterative process?
People try to establish that there's one highest and best use for a property as if it's a unitary thing and you can only build this one item. And that's just not what happens in the market.
Oh. Yeah, I think maybe you're misunderstanding then.
No.
Yeah, because
do tell.
Highest and best use is a filter, right? So we think about physically and legally possible and permissible. And what could the property, if it's an acre, it's a very different universe of potential than if it's 100 acres, right? From that, what returns more than a dollar? So what is financially feasible? What makes that? What increases that value? What use makes that better? And then from all those potential things that could increase the value, return more than a dollar in value, which one makes the most? That's how you get to highest and best use. It's not, it's one simple thing, unless all those things are the same. They're almost never all the same. The market drives all that.
Yeah. And then people try to say they know the answer. This is just like economists insisting that they can essentially predict the future because everyone's rational. It's not like that in the real world. People build things and you don't necessarily know why. And it's not predictable what that item is going to be. But people seem to insist for purposes analysis that they know that it absolutely is going to be this thing. And then it turns out to just not be that at all.
Our job as appraisers is to come up with a credible opinion of value based on this hypothetical buyer and seller. And every comp we use, if it's a transaction, that's not market value. That's a price. It's a fact. We extrapolate from that and put it into this hypothetical world called an appraisal. So you're right, Ross. We are working in this realm of This is an opinion, and it's based under these parameters so that you can follow the logic of our thinking and see how we got to this opinion. What actually happens in the real world is somebody just got a huge order on a manufacturing product, and they're like, oh crap, like this is our make or break moment. We've got to go get new space, and we got to do it this month so that we can get the orders out in 8 months. And that means I'm going to go pay whatever I have to pay in order to get the space I need to meet the demand that my business has, right? And so now suddenly, it has nothing to do with the real estate. They just got to get this done, but they need real estate to do it. Same thing with Walgreens. They have a business model that they are trying to move forward, and real estate is a component of it. So it is this tension, honestly, between what the appraisers are doing, which is trying to establish the broader, bigger, amorphous market, versus what particular specific humans are doing with their actual real estate.
I think it's important, particularly for eminent domain, is this is not a market transaction. On its face, the owner did not say, I am offering this property. The agency is saying, I need this property for another use that has nothing to do with your value. So that creation of the highest and best use, and that analysis that brings you to that, which drives comparable selection, data analysis and selection, has to be hypothetical.
Has to be a Walgreens. Just pave every parcel on the entire corridor in a Walgreens, just side by side, every single one of them, all the way down. Except at each corner, put a 7-Eleven.
I'm sensing sour grapes here. Not that wine's my thing. But.
Yeah, you know, I will tell you, I think things are a little bit different in Virginia than other parts of the country, and I'm going to leave it at that. I think that we see some different tactics here that maybe are not so prevalent in Texas. Talking there, I know a number of landowner attorneys in Texas who are just fantastic, and they seem to approach things a little bit differently, and they don't generate as much cynicism among their opponents, I think. But we're jaded, and I admit that, listeners, so I apologize in advance.
Christina, do you ever want to look at Ross and Dave and just say, who hurt you?
I do, actually. I might have said that in our very, very first a long time ago.
You know what?
The appraisers.
That rings a bell. I'm pretty sure you did. Good question.
Yeah. That's true. So let's stick with the Walgreens. Do you guys, the Walgreens theme, and shift gears a little bit, but stay in the same realm. Do you guys appraise many convenience stores or gas stations or things that you're going to see on a busy corner?
Oh, yeah.
That was an interesting answer. So
yes,
let's talk a little bit. I think they're a little bit
answering the question that was asked, sir.
Yeah, I know. They're a little bit different animals is what I gather. In the approach that you take and what's important. And there's this thing called FF&E, and there are frequently environmental concerns, I think. And so I just wondered if we could have a little bit of a discussion about the differences in gas stations and convenience stores, which are frequently attached to gas stations from other types of property.
So I routinely do them. But I'm not as elegant in my analysis as Anthony is. So I'll let him take that one.
Sure. So with a gas station, it's with any property type, what is motivating the buyer? And with operating convenience stores with a fuel service, a lot of times what is motivating that buyer when they're looking at competitive properties, right? The theory of substitution is what's behind the sales comparison approach. So I'm looking at competitive properties. If I'm looking at an office building, it's probably price per square foot, or what could I rent it for per square foot? If you're looking at an operating convenience store, you are looking at the fuel sales. You're looking at the inside sales. You're looking at the lottery component. And when you're looking for upside, can I put food service in here? Is there room to grow that food service? So that's when the metric is no longer price per square foot, because your sales might have $75 to $750 per square foot. But if you know that operating income, the going concern, now the gross profit multiplier, really tight range, 2.9 to 3.5. And you can actually sort of discriminate what is driving the multiplier there. FF&E is a part of that. And where people kind of mess up, I see with gas stations all the time, is they don't break out the FF&E. And USPAF is pretty clear that you have to identify anything contributing to the value. And so if your comp is a sale of an operating gas station, not least, it's fee simple, well, you've got the real estate, the land, buildings, and bricks and all that, but you also have the FF&E, the reach-in coolers, the underground storage tanks, the canopy, the dispensers. And then you also have, if it was a turnkey sale, you have the potential for some sort of intangible or business value as a component of that one comp. So you've got to identify those different components, break them out so that you at least are explaining what it is. And when it comes to eminent domain, so many of those items may or may not be compensable. And if you haven't broken them out and you're saying, yeah, it's a total take, okay, $2 million. Well, how much is the FF&E? How much is the going concern or intangible business component? And you want to make sure that the agency is clear about what they are compensating the owners for.
Explain what you mean, for those of us uninformed, explain what you mean by FF&E and why it's different than the value of the building.
Sure. The furniture, fixtures, and equipment. And it gets a little confusing because fixtures are oftentimes real property. But if those are just the equipment, would be something simple like a coffee maker or a point of sale system. But if it's attached, or it would be extremely difficult or costly to remove that item, now it's more of a fixture. And it gets real nuanced sometimes how people define these things. But the building itself is obviously attached to the land, like it's versus the right. Shelving of the convenience store. Sorry, I'm not sure if I'm explaining this.
No,
well.
You are, but it raises a question, you know, FF&E for dummies, which is me. Why are the first F and the E, how come they're not just subject to Ms. Short when she comes through to relocate things? Why are they a component of value, or are they?
So they are a component, but if we can allocate to them and say this is the furniture and the equipment, these are the things that are going to move. The metal canopy probably isn't going to move. The underground storage tanks probably aren't going to move. So those would be compensated a different way. But in the appraisal, the problem is when people are including those items but not separating them. So then are you paid for them and you get relocation services and benefits?
That's where it's important to know about your comparable data. Did it include FF&E? That's why verification and clarification with a buyer or seller is so important.
And I'll say, for me, that's my jumping off point. If you paid for it in the appraisal, I can't pay to move it. And I can't tell you how many times I've done C-stores and gas stations where I go walk in, I look at the appraisal, I'm like, I don't know, like the drink machine, the walk-in cooler, the this, the that, the this. Like it just says, there was some personal property on site. I'm like, I have to call the appraiser and go, what was your intention here? What was this? So those of you that address that in the appraisal up front, boy, you make us relo agents very happy.
But do these things actually transact on a sales comparison approach basis? Is that really what they do, or is it on the multiple like you were talking about?
So the operating convenience stores, and I've done, gosh, hundreds of them, more on the lender side before I was all right of way all the time. It is still a sales comparison approach. But the unit, it's based on the multiple. And it's not even the EBITDA, because the buyers are like, well, the margins are kind of fixed, but I'll get better expenses. I'll run a leaner ship. So our payroll will go down and I'll negotiate something else. So it's not even the EBITDA multiplier as much as the gross profit multiplier from what I've researched.
But how do you get the comp data for those, since that's not reported as the sale of the real estate? If you need that for analysis, where does that come from?
So there are brokers who specialize in this property type. And so they are my friends. We hang out. And I call them and I'm like, hey, what's the deal? And oftentimes when they list the property, if you know where to look for these listings, it says right there on the listing what the fuel sales are, what the inside sales are, what the, I mean, they tell you because that's what the buyer wants to know. So this data is there. It isn't readily available for, say, the same people who are going on CoStar or the local MLS. And that's what makes it a niche. People specialize in convenience store valuations, just like they specialize in bed and breakfast.
Bed and breakfast?
Yeah.
Where are these people? We got to get them on here. I want to go to some bed and breakfasts.
That's what makes it a real estate appraisal niche. And you can tell it's a niche, too, if there are brokers who also specialize in it. Because now they know they've identified a pool of buyers that they want to speak with people knowledgeable.
Do those brokers operate on sort of a larger geographic footprint?
Yes.
Yeah.
This episode of Infrastructure Junkies is generously sponsored by Blackbird Right of Way. If you are looking for compliant, timely, and innovative relocation solutions, this is exactly what Blackbird does. Kristen Short and her team deliver every parcel, every time. Find them at blackbirdrow.com. BlackbirdRow.com.
Question.
Okay.
Do you guys have bar names?
I do.
So, I do not.
Not since about 1987.
Well, I have good news for you.
You have bar.
You're going to get bar names. So before.
Wait, I already got one.
No, you don't.
No.
You're getting
we're
one.
We're giving you a new one.
So what is a bar name? And my very good friend, Cindy Welpley, when Kristen and I met her at the World Climb, she identified that her bar name is Julie. And like, well, what's a bar name? Well, when you're out at a bar and you don't want anybody to know your real name. And I had one left over from the 1990s. And my bar name was so sophisticated, I had a first name and a last name. And it's,
what?
Yeah, it's Chad Harwick. And so they're like, what's your name? You don't say Chad, you say it's Chad Harwick. It's an era of sophistication that really blends with my aura, right?
Of course, Dave would be a Chad or a self-declared Chad.
So sophisticated.
Damn right, man.
So sophisticated.
And so Kristen's like, well, I don't have a bar name. And she does now, and it is?
Courtney.
Yep.
Hi.
Perfect. Perfect. Courtney. Yeah, it goes right with it. Anthony, Christina, and Ross, we thought about this before we went on to this podcast episode, and we thought about your personalities after the last one, and you're really going to have bar names, and we're going to use them in Long Beach when we go to conference.
I'd like to mention that Dave and I may have spent more time contemplating your bar names than we did the entire rest of the outline of this podcast. So these are very carefully chosen bar names.
True story.
So who should we start with?
These are curated, bespoke bar names.
Let's start with Christina. Christina, okay. Yours was easy. I threw a name out there and Dave said, that's it. No question. So Christina Thorson, your bar name is Josie.
Oh, yep. I like it.
Right? We thought like you would be a good... Like, and the Pussycats, yes.
That's one of the reasons we chose it, because it will foster conversation, because some drunk dude will be like, what's your name? And you'll be like, Josie, where's your Pussycats? And then
see?
You can dump your drink on him, or you can continue the conversation, or you can call Thor over and he'll take care of it. Yeah, you're
exactly.
Welcome.
Yeah. Okay, who's next?
Rachel.
Anthony.
So they established that no effort was spent on Christina's name.
Well, it just jumped out.
No,
at
it
us.
Was perfect.
Okay,
like
so that leaves...
we knew it. The universe plopped it into our laps. We're like, that is her bar name. She's Josie. Full stop.
Yep.
It fits.
Yep.
Dave, why don't you tell Anthony what his bar name is?
Anthony, yours is a little special, and
it is special.
You have to approach it correctly when you divulge your bar name. Okay, and it's inspired by the Karate Kid. I'm just gonna say.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And what it is your bar name is Ricky with an E. And you always have to say, what's your name? It's Ricky with an E. Remember Allie with an I?
Like Allie with an I? I'm Allie with an I?
So yeah.
You can't just say my name's Ricky. You have to always say Ricky with an E.
With an E.
You right, don't seem very excited. What?
No, is Ricky the guy in the Karate Kid? Which one was
no,
he?
No, there is no Ricky, but it's Ricky with an E, just like in the Karate Kid, it's Allie with an I.
Oh.
So it's just inspired by Allie with an I.
In my head, in my head, Anthony is Tony the Goat. So like, just so.
Tony the Goat. But
Ricky with an E.
He is
Ricky with an E. You got
completely
it?
Completely unenthused with his bar
name. I like it.
Josie
like
liked it. Hers. Ricky, not so much.
I was thinking like the Karate Kid. Like, is that the kid who is like.
It's going to be Johnny.
Oh, that's Johnny.
Johnny. Yeah.
Take
Danielson.
Sweep the leg.
His knee.
For the record, Daniel is the bad guy in that show.
By the way, what if we literally said it's inspired by Karate Kid? Guess what, Anthony? Your bar name is Mr. Miyagi.
Johnny is clearly the good guy.
Hi, I'm Courtney. This is my friend Josie and our pal, Mr. Miyagi.
Wax on, wax off.
No. No.
We run with a tough crowd.
We do. We do. Okay.
They'll be Ross. Like, why do you call him Mr. Miyagi? Well, and it's not because of wax on. Okay. Do you want to tell Ross what his is?
Oh, my goodness.
I don't accept this, whatever it is.
Ross, your bar name is... I feel like you're going to like it. Okay. Your bar name, it was between two and it was a tough call, but your bar name is Otis.
I mean,
this is so bland. I'm just like, okay, you're going to say it and I'm going to be like, what?
That's not bland.
Otis.
Otis. Otis is sophisticated and cool. Sophisticated. Otis is a good one.
Sitting in the morning.
See?
Otis Ray.
That's right.
Sing it, Josie. Sing it, Josie.
Josie, well, I'll be the pussycat for that one.
Do you want to know what the alternative was?
Well, why did you pick? How did we get to Otis anyway?
Well, I'll tell you some of the thought processes. We were like, Ross needs a name that's like not a standard name, but doesn't sound ridiculous. And then we were like thinking of like little short names, like
the first suggestion was Leslie. So
well, it
that
says,
was Dave's suggestion.
It's the name of the State of Michigan Offender Tracking Information System.
That tracks.
How do you know this stuff?
I'm sure he just Googled it.
Well, you were getting either Otis or Ringo, so.
I fully accept Ringo. That's fine.
Well, then you can have Ringo. How about that?
Okay. Change it. Ringo. So okay. We got Ringo, Josie, Mr. Miyagi, Courtney, and Chad Harwick. What a raucous crew. Look out, Long Beach.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
I'm Ricky with an E, okay?
Okay. You are Ricky with an E. Yes, you are. Yes.
We'll get Julie. Who else did we give bar? We gave bar names to some other people. Stevie, Julie.
Yep. We have several.
Anyway. All right. Back to appraisal stuff that people actually want to hear about. Let's talk about, and frequently we get an expert designation in, and of course there's always an appraiser, and sometimes there's a land planner, and almost as often as not, there's a broker listed as an expert witness, which kind of begs the question, like sometimes the brokers are trying to slip in value or opinions of value there. And I've had some actually tell me, well, I can do a CMA, so absolutely I can testify to value.
Oh, boy.
And they can't. I mean, they can't, but they'll tell you that, and they'll try to put one over on you.
They can testify to price, what they would price a property for.
I don't think that's admissible, though.
This all seems like some kind of market manipulation where the appraisers got one over on the brokers in terms of who got what put in the legislation. Because whenever you ask the question, it's like, we got to ask the broker. We got to get the data from the broker. I need a broker. It's like, well, then what do we need you for? Like, bring the broker over here.
No. Do you all talk to brokers? We get these disclosures, and your disclosure is a written document which identifies the experts, including the appraiser, and the bases on which delivers their opinions and the bases on it. And they'll say, well, I spoke to brokers or I spoke to market participants, and they list all of these categories of people that they spoke to, which I'm sure is supposed to be in their work file, and then you press them on it and they'll be like, well, I don't really remember. I talked to somebody. Do you all go out and talk to brokers? Do you talk to market participants? Or do you really need them?
Absolutely. I think brokers are a crucial part of that process. I often confirm data with brokers because they can usually give me the story, the side from the buyer and the seller in the transaction, because they've been party to both parts, and that informs the motivations of both parties, which helps us understand why the price ended up being the way it was.
Give me an example of what the heck you just said.
Okay. So I've got the sale of...
Christina, call me. I sold a 100,000 square foot industrial building. Hey, who's there?
Yeah. This is Christina Thorson. I'm a real estate appraiser, and I'm working on an appraisal in your market. And I understand you do a lot of real estate transactions, and there's one sale in particular I'm really curious about, why it ended up at $10 million for that property that sold back in December. I do have the right facts, don't I?
Who are you? You're an appraiser?
I'm a real estate appraiser. What's happening is there is a transportation project. You know, they're widening Highway 31, and they're going to be, I think, significantly impacting one of those property owners. And I want to make sure that that owner is fairly treated. So you helping me understand the transaction helps me better analyze it so I can make sure that my opinion of value is accurate.
Well, the sales price you mentioned is accurate. However, right. It was reduced by about $100,000 because they had to put a new roof on immediately after going in.
Oh, so the buyer spent a little less money. The listing price was higher?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the buyer, who you know, I guess, after they bought it, they put the new roof on?
That was their plan. That was part of the negotiations, yeah. So that was impacting the price that you saw there, was that roof.
Okay. And how long, do you remember how long that property was on the market before y'all came under contract?
I think it was about 6 months, but I'm a busy guy. I don't really remember.
That's fair. If you don't mind, could you have your assistant email me the MLS sheet or the commercial listing sheet on that? That would be terrific.
I'll do it. Click. Awesome. See ya.
So, first of all, Oscars for everyone. That was a wonderful reenactment. So you have these conversations on a regular basis, correct?
Yeah.
Wow.
And if they're friendly, we'll start talking about like, well, what's the market doing generally? But those are very matter of course. An example of a more pressing one. So I did the natural gas pipeline going down the underneath a truck court on a parallel, like right underneath it. So these trucks are going to be running over it, all the like giant trucks. And the language of the easement was very much in favor of the gas company. Understandably, that's what you do. And so the property owner was concerned, like, if my trucks, which we already have this truck court, we already have these trucks, if when this concrete buckles as it does and we have to repair it, could this become a liability for me having to deal with this high pressure gas line underneath it? And so I had to call a lot of brokers who specialize in that particular industrial property type to see if they had ever dealt with anything like this, how they felt like the market, their buyers who they represent, would treat something like this. And then I included their names and their contact information and write-ups, like little interview summaries in my report, because it was such a very specific thing that I couldn't quite figure out it's any sort of paired sales approach to account for that. And I told him, I was like, listen, I'm putting this into a report. It's litigious, but your name is going to be in there. And they're like, okay, but I hope they don't call me. And some people were like, no, don't put my name in there. Keep my name out. But I'll tell you. And so I had to put redacted. But again, to your point, Dave, it was in the work file. But I have also seen all those same comments, and not every time is there someone specific in mind when you see that market participants interview. I like to see the interviews in the report. If you interviewed somebody, if you say you talked to somebody, put them in there. Mm-hmm. How do they support what you're saying this value is?
One more tiny point. The other benefit to talking to brokers who work in that market, either geographically or that property type, is asking them what else do they know about that maybe is not on the market yet, or how they priced it, or what else has closed that you think is similar to the property you're telling me about now. And that's very valuable in terms of getting in the shoes of the buyer to think about what the reasonable substitutes are, because the pricing is based on substitution.
Fascinating. Well, you know what, guys? I don't really know what to say about this episode. I think that our guests provided fantastic insight. I didn't really add much to this one, but this ranks in one of the absolute top most fun Infrastructure Junkie podcast episodes we've ever done.
Agreed.
This was fantastic. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
I don't think you made anybody mad in this episode.
Ringo?
Well, when I'm right, how can they help but agree?
Well, there is that.
Fair point.
Well, Ringo, Ricky with an E, Josie, Chad Harwick, thanks for joining us. This was a great episode, and I hope you guys will come back and see us again sometime.
Anytime.
Thanks, Courtney.
Thank you, Courtney. Thank you, Chad Harwick. Bye, everybody.
Bye.